This is Tape 1, Side A of the Open University course English 102, Composition in Native Indian Literature 1. On this tape, course author Patty Hartford talks to Bill Reed, the author of The Raven and the First Men. The date of this interview is February 16, 1993, and Bill Reed is at his home in Vancouver, and Patty Hartford is at her home in Kamloops, B.C., and their conversation was recorded at the Open Learning Agency in Burnaby. Of all the tapes in this course, you'll find that this one is the most difficult to hear. Bill Reed has Parkinson's disease and his voice is quite weak, but you'll find that your struggle to understand him will be rewarded. His ideas are robust and stimulating.
I think our interview is going to be a little bit different from many that I've had. I have a list of standard questions that we've been asking most of these people who are primarily writers, and I can think of so many more interesting things that I want to ask you, so I'm probably going to diverge a little bit just because of the nature of your work in general. So I guess all I can say is hang on to your hat here. I don't know where we're going. One of the things that strikes me about the differences here is that you are primarily a visual artist, and you're internationally known for your sculpture and jewelry and things that people would generally consider a different sort of art form from literature. What inspired you to expand your artistic endeavors to storytelling?
I'd done a little bit of writing off and on when I was in broadcasting. I did wrote a few pieces for them and for the CBC, just because I was there and happened to know a little bit about the field of the Northwest Coast. I've never written about anything much except the Northwest Coast. But I didn't really do anything very much until there was a great series of books published in the on the art of the Northwest Coast out here, most of them by Douglas McIntyre. And I don't know, it got to be kind of a convention to have me write a foreword or a preface or something for them. And I did a little bit of writing as a result of that. But the main thing happened, I guess, the storytelling happened because George MacDonald did his book, Monumental Art, and he wanted some little chapter headings, drawings. So I did six or seven of them, and then the gallery I was at that time decided they'd like to have a show of these drawings, and there weren't enough of them, so I did some more, and hard to get the sequence right in my head. And then I think Scott McIntyre came along and asked if I'd be interested in doing a book with the drawings and with some captions, just expanded captions, I guess. And so I said, why don't we do some of the legends or interpretations of them and see how it comes out. And I sat down and wrote them, and with the help of Robert Bringhurst, who did two of the stories, and we helped each other on the ones that we were doing on our own.
Have you published any other writing since?
The article in the Islands at the Edge, which was edited by John Broadhead for Douglas McIntyre, I don't know if you've seen the book. It's in support of the establishment of the wilderness area in South Moresby in the Queen Charlotte. Very beautiful book, actually, to look at, and pretty good reading. And I did the opening diatribe, which has worn out pretty well.
It's certainly creative and very artistic writing, and I've often thought, my goodness, he could do this as well as he does his more traditional artwork. The art forms that are being explored by Native people today are becoming more and more diversified. Do you see any themes that you feel should be examined across these various art forms? Are there some things that stand out to you as being a prime area for Native people to speak out?
Well, I don't know anything about what's going on in the rest of the country. I know what's going on in the rest of the country, but I'm not terrifically involved in it. And I would like to see my own people, the ones on the coast here, explore a little bit more into the arts of the past before jumping off into any wild experimental efforts. I think that it's not any reflection on the people who are making the objects of reflecting the arts of the past out here, but they just haven't got an opportunity to learn the skills and the design forms that are available to people with a more diverse skill training. It's been 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. About 40 years since we started this so-called revival of the Northwest Coast material, and mostly in the line, jewelry line, and we still have no trained jewelers in the Native community, and I don't know why this is. They learned how to make a product that was saleable, mostly riding on the reputations of their ancestors, I'm afraid, and they haven't been able to progress beyond that in the metalwork. And we hope to do something about rectifying that situation by opening experimental arts and crafts program, if we want a better word, and see if we can get the skills up to a point where they can provide the language by which old arts can be better interpreted for the people of today, and then they can, I hope, go on to bigger and better things. It's a kind of a critical moment at the present time, because I think the goodwill that has carried them along so far is wearing a little bit thin here and there, and it's time for an reassessment of the actual worth of what's being done these days, and try to get some ideas of how it can be improved or diversified.
Are you, or is someone else, actually planning to carry out workshops, teaching clinics to teach Native artists more about the traditional work?
All I can say is that at the present time we have a very loose idea that we would like to do something in an experimental way to increase the skills and potential of younger would-be artists in one village as a start, and with the hope that it will give everybody some ideas as to where they can go. And I'm involved in it, and I know more of the mechanical business of producing this kind of material than anybody else at the present time, I suppose. And so we hope to use what knowledge I've gained in the last half century to, before, while I still have the strength and stamina to do something about it. And I think there's a fairly good atmosphere for introducing that kind of thing at the present time.
What's your feeling about non-native people working with traditionally native art forms? Whether it's
anything wrong with it, that if anybody can derive something beautiful and worthwhile from these beautiful and worthwhile designs of the past, then it's more power to them. But I really think that there is a something to having them built into your genealogy, more or less, that is almost necessary. I've seen beautifully executed, beautifully designed pieces, better in all its mechanical aspects than what's being done by the native carvers, but it's lacking in something, and maybe I'm just looking for differences and for shortcomings. But I think there is a certain distance you can go, and by just observing the old ways of doing things, and then on it there's a kind of an emotional involvement which is more exciting and more interesting than just a mechanical reproduction. And but it is necessary to have a physical wherewithal to interpret these things before you can get at the real source of the appeal.
I think actually you've just reiterated what many of the writers have told us in answer to a similar question, and that is that there is something in the spirit of it that's lacking. The technique and the form may be there to some degree, but it's the real feeling and the spirit that aren't there. Did I understand that the way you would have said it?
I think that's more or less what I'm trying to get at.
When we talked earlier, we talked about the two different versions of the Raven and the First Man. The story that we are using in the course is the one from the collection of Raven stories called The Raven Steals the Light. And but I have also heard a shorter version. We've asked you to read one today. Which one have you chosen to read from?
Well, I haven't got the shorter version here, so I guess...
Okay, all right. We'd love to hear the longer one.
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Great flood which had covered the earth for so long had at last receded, and even the thin strip of sand now called Rose Spit, stretching north from Nykoon village, lay dry. The raven had flown there to gorge himself on the delicacies left by the receding water, so for once he wasn't hungry. But his other appetites, lust, curiosity, and the unquenchable itch to meddle and to provoke things, to play tricks on the world and its creatures, these remained unsatisfied. He had recently stolen the light from the old man who kept it hidden in a box in his house in the middle of darkness, and had scattered it throughout the sky. The new light spattered the night with stars and waxed and waned in the shape of the moon, and it dazzled the day with a single bright shining, which lit up the long beach that curved from the spit beneath the raven's feet westward as far as Toe Hill. Pretty as it was, it looked lifeless, and so did the raven, quite boring. He gave a great sigh, crossed his wings behind his back, and walked along the sand, his shiny head cocked, his sharp eyes and ears alert for some unusual sight or sound. Then, taking to the air, he called petulantly out to the empty sky. To his delight, he heard an answering cry, or to describe it more accurately, a muffled squeak. At first he saw nothing, but as he scanned the beach, a white flash caught his eye. And when he landed, he found at his feet, half buried in the sand, a gigantic clamshell. When he looked more closely still, he saw that the shell was full of little creatures, cowering in the terror of his enormous shadow. Well, here was something to break the monotony of his day. But nothing was going to happen as long as the tiny things stayed in their shell, and they certainly weren't coming out in their present terrified state. So the raven leaned his great head close to the shell with the smooth trickster's tongue that had got him into and out of so many misadventures during his troubled and troublesome existence. He coaxed and cajoled and coerced the little creatures to come out and play in his wonderful new world. As you know, the raven speaks in two voices, one harsh and strident, and the other, which he used now, a seductive bell-like croon which seemed to come from the depths of the sea or out of the cave where the winds are born. It is an irresistible sound, one of the loveliest sounds in the world. So it wasn't long before one and another of the little shell dwellers timidly emerged. Some of them immediately scurried back when they saw the immensity of the sky and the sea and the overwhelming blackness of the raven. But eventually, curiosity overcame caution, and all of them had crept or scrambled out. Very strange creatures they were, too. Two-legged, like the raven, but there the resemblance ended. They had no glossy feathers, no thrusting beak. Their skin was very pale, and they were naked except for the long black hair on their round, flat-featured heads. Instead of strong wings, they had thin, stick-like appendages that waved and fluttered constantly. They were the original hiders, the first humans.
I have a question about the beginnings of the story. The story isn't a direct translation from the Haida, yet it is very widely recognized as perhaps a more artistic rendition of a traditional oral tale. As an artist, what artistic liberties do you feel you might have taken in the stories that would make them different, say, from a version told by a Haida storyteller?
Well, you know, the translations I read have not been very inspiring. They were functional and they gave the gist of the story, but they weren't literary examples. They weren't too much. But so I just thought when I had to do these things that I just write them the way I wanted to write them and let it go with that. I don't know whether I do it that way now or not. Most of the details, the main structure of the story come from. I was never too concerned with the authenticity in a mechanical sort of a way. I wanted to tell a good story, and I hope I did in some cases. And I also wanted it to be easy to read aloud by English-speaking people. And so it's much more English than Haida, probably.
What kind of response have you had from Haida people about your...
Well, I got most of the stories from Henry Young. who's a friend of my father, grandfather's, and same age, and lives across the street from him. They were both widowers, and spent a great deal of time in their retirement years together. But Henry spoke fairly good English, and my grandfather didn't speak any at all. I don't even know if he knew the stories. We developed some kind of a communication, but it wasn't a very practical one for the transmission of information.
So do you, did people like Henry Young and others from that Haida community give you any feedback about your stories as they were published?
Well, they couldn't read them, so they really, I never really read them to them. And I've had no complaints. I expected to have some arguments about the details of the text and so on. The only objection I ever had was from James Young, who was Henry's surviving son, I think. And he, we were down at the hot springs one summer, and I had this book with me, and I was reading it to some kids who had arrived on a camping trip, and James was listening in, and we got to the somewhat salacious parts of the stories, James said that he counted my statement that I got the stories from Henry, because he said Henry would never have told stories with situations like that. That he was never heard these stories of the raven philanderer or any of the other human characteristics he had.
The story that that I referred to earlier, the shorter version, was one that some students might be familiar with, because it was you read from it on a CBC special that was done in October of 92, the war against the Indians. And I thought it was interesting to see the contrast between the two stories. Can you explain a little bit about the other version, how it came to be?
The only other version I can think of is just a précis that was included in some of the prints, prints we made from the just offset litho prints from the drawings I did, I guess if you shorten them as much as you had to get them in those few lines, that would change the flavor of the story considerably. But
were they specifically asking you to get rid of some of the suggestions there, or was that just to shorten it down?
Just to shorten it down.
Would Haida storytellers tell both versions to different audiences, or say different versions to different audiences?
Well, we don't know, because Haida history is something that's pretty well lost. And aside from the stories themselves, the legends, which contains something, I suppose, of the history, but in a very different and non-linear way. But as far as the puritanical side of the whole thing is concerned, there wasn't any observation of it at all. It was, you don't live in a extended family household and have to be protected from the facts of life, particularly. And I'm sure that everybody knew everything that was there was good and bad and moral and immoral at a very early age, and that it all grist for the myth-making mill.
The aspect about Native oral literature and particularly the traditional tales is the understanding of reality. Many of the non-Native students, and I suppose some Native students as well, struggle to define a Native understanding of what non-Native sometimes dismiss as just myth. How do you understand the reality of these stories?
I'm a product of a great overlay of myths, going back to the Greeks and the Norse and all the European mythologies have shaped us much more than the more practical aspects of our past. And I really don't know whether there was these legends were presented as a serious account of the origins of the of everything that shaped and influenced the lives of the Haidas and the other people. I think they were just told because they were interesting and entertaining and the ones that had some meaning beyond the superficial accounting of events were the ones that survived and were used over and over again in gatherings of people. I think a non-literate society probably has a very limited literature, because it has to be carried around in certain individuals' heads, and it's, you can't have a huge archives on that basis. But so they had to, I think, appreciate the same details of the story. The novelty was not a much sought-after aspect of any of their arts. What they wanted to see was the refinement of a aspect of their lives. The good graphic artists and plastic artists were encouraged to refine their approach to their arts and to as much as possible, but not to get too adventurous or just too far from the conventions that they were brought up in.
A strong correlation between this kind of storytelling and the kind of storytelling that you might do in your artwork?
They would instantly recognize, of course, what story was being depicted in whatever medium was chosen by the artist to work in. In effect, that you what happened is you would come upon a new totem pole or something like that, and immediately recount to yourself the stories that inspired the different groupings of the creatures on the pole.
Can you offer any advice to a student in this course who is about to read The Raven and the First Men for the first time?
Oh, just read it out loud for one thing, and just enjoy it as a story. If it's a good story, then that's all it has to be. It's the same as the decorative arts that are very popular with the public out here in British Columbia, and you know, that's the middle class, fairly well educated parents introduce their children to these creatures in the forms that they occur in around the city of Vancouver, say, for instance, where I have three or four pieces here and there, and the other people have the same thing, and they become a distinctive part of the immigrant communities. Environment as well as the native, and so I think that they're just nobody's sat down and says I have to have an explanation of how the moon and the stars and the sun occurred, so I'll tell a story about the raven that will offer an explanation of how these phenomena occurred. They just, I suppose, over a period of time, the stories would be roughed out and refined by different people. It is said, Henry Young told me this, that he was the last of the trained storytellers from his part of the island, and that his uncle would make him repeat the stories over word for word until he had them letter perfect, and then he would be allowed to tell them at feasts or celebrations of some kind. And so it was. They change very little.
So we should just listen to it as a story and enjoy it for the beauty of the story itself.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate your time today. Okay. It's been really nice talking to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks very much.